Emmanuel, as I was coming up, we had not had a chance to meet yet, and I heard you say, I'd sure like to see Dean Miller. I haven't heard many of my brethren say that. I appreciate that. And I'd like to talk to that gal who made the observation about you. I'd like to know whether or not she was wearing glasses. It reminded me of a story that Brother Tom Holland once told us preacher boys at Fried Hardeman. He said there was one fella that was complimenting the other fella about his wife and said, "Boy, your wife sure looks great." To which the reply was, "Compared to what?" I don't know what she was saying you look great like or compared to, but I'm glad you got that compliment. I would be remiss if I did not express my thanks to Emmanuel and to the School of Preaching here for the invitation to participate on the lectureship series. It certainly is a privilege because I think more than anything, because of the work of the School of Preaching, and to be able to share in that great work, it really is a privilege. Because the work is tremendous, and I often stand in amazement of our good brethren who are so very much involved in the work of the Lord in the scenario of the Christian colleges and our schools of preaching. They do a fantastic job. And I certainly wish a great deal of divine blessings upon the School of Preaching here and the good work that is being done here. No doubt, numerous people are profiting greatly by the investment of time and effort and energy here at the school. Religions abound. There is no doubt about the fact that we live in a world filled with religions. Imagine, if you will, and maybe for some of us it would be quite difficult, the challenge before a God-seeking soul who is trying to make their initial steps in the direction of their Creator, but really not knowing where to turn. What does that individual do in our day and age? As they open their newspaper and they look at the long list of possible church options. And then they go to the yellow pages and they see even more. And then they drive through their communities and they see worship place after worship place. Where does that God-seeking soul turn anyway to find the right direction toward their Creator? The situation is not unlike the hungry man at the all-you-can-eat food bar. Maybe some of you were there just a little over an hour ago. You know, the spread is so big, the options are so numerous, the variety is just overwhelming. And you ask yourself, where in the world do I start? Well, in an obviously much more serious way, the God-seeking person of our day and age who doesn't have a notion about where to start faces a huge dilemma. We live in a world that features a religion buffet. And that God-seeking person, I can just imagine them asking, where do I go? Where do I start? They might choose a world religion. They might choose Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, Judaism, Islam. Maybe they would choose to go the route of a cultic religion to find God and find themselves among the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witness, the Christian Science, maybe the occult, maybe Scientology, maybe among the New Age movement folks. Maybe that individual would choose to go the route of a Protestant denomination. And so they would go to the Baptist or the Presbyterian or the Methodist or the Lutherans or the Nazarenes. Of course, we know where they ought to turn. To the Bible, to God's book. But that individual who's taking those initial steps toward God and is desiring God in their life, sometimes they do not know that is where they ought to turn. And so they'll turn to some sort of already existing religion, and try to begin experiencing the religion buffet of our world. And it's no wonder that some folks become frustrated, become disappointed, and are very confused, and even throw up their hands, and maybe after a while even walk away from their attempt to move in the direction of God because of a world filled with contradicting religions. A United Methodist preacher back in the early 70s by the name of J. Gordon Melton, he produced a set of volumes entitled The Encyclopedia of American Churches. And in his research, what he did, he took a broad panoramic view of religion in America, and he put all American religions into 17 families according to their unique characteristics or practices. And in those 17 family groups, he listed 1,200 different religions in America. That was in the 70s, in the early 70s. Imagine if someone were to begin such a project in the 90s. In a book entitled World Religions in America, edited by a Jacob Neusner, he writes about the state of religion in America and the multitudinous variety that we have available. He says on page 2 of this book, Americans are not only a religious people, we also are a people of many religions. Most of the religions of the world are practiced in America. And then he begins to describe some of the American religion makeup in a demographic sort of way, and how some of the percentages break down, and how we are so different religiously. Later, in this same introduction section, he says, the marvel of America is its capacity to give a home to nearly every religion in the world. On the next page, he comments, today, this country has become the meeting place for nearly all of the living religions of the world. So he concludes, what we learn in this book that he is writing is that nearly every religion in the world is practiced by some Americans. That is pretty overwhelming when you stop to think about it. America is just one country. The world is so huge. And when you think about all the people of the world and all of the diversity of the religions of the people of the world, to think that one could accurately say that virtually every religion in the entire world is practiced by some Americans is some indication of just how abounding religions are in America. Why is that so? No doubt, we in our country have created a fertile ground in which to grow all sorts of different religions. One reason is obviously the political doctrine of American freedom. Religious freedom in particular. We prize and we practice our freedom of religion in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or forbidding the free exercise thereof. And who among us would want to give up our religious freedom? Something that we hold near and dear to us, and something that we benefit greatly from, is our religious freedom in our country. But that doctrine of religious freedom that we have that's fundamental in our country has really added to the dilemma we have with our religious diversity, because not everyone is going to exercise that freedom in a rational and in a responsible fashion. A second reason why America has an abundance of divergent religions is a mindset in our country. And it's a growing mindset in our culture that really, to a great extent, is being adopted by us in the church as well. We can use different words for it. We can call it pluralism. We can call it tolerance. We can call it egalitarianism. The idea is, what we need to be doing in our world is seeking to communicate with others to understand them. Not to challenge conflicting philosophies and ideas, but just to understand one another better and enjoy a peaceful coexistence with one another. The emphasis is on being non-judgmental. And I am all for not being hypercritical. And I am all for, personally, us making a point to avoid all sorts of unnecessary and unjust judgments. But there is a place for sound judgment. Indeed, we need to be people who are discerning in our judgments. Not hasty, but careful and fair. And if we're all honest, we all make judgments. But in our culture today, more and more, there's this emphasis on being non-judgmental to an extreme. To such an extreme that I heard just a few months ago, a brother, Applegard Smith, who is a lawyer and who is a professor at Pepperdine University, who teaches law students, who commented about the problem that we're having with these classic, high visible cases that are becoming the darling of the media, and how that, he says, more and more what is happening is these people who have had it pounded into them for years and years now, don't judge, don't judge, don't judge. When we put them in an arena where they need to practice sound judgment for the benefit of the society as a whole, they can't do it. Because it has become so ingrained in them that they are not to judge, period. So what happened with the Menendez brothers initially? And he claimed also at the same time that that probably had a lot to do with the verdict in the O.J. Simpson case. We live in a world, in a country, that has this beautiful political doctrine of religious freedom. But not everybody uses it sensibly and responsibly. We live in a country that has been very much a culture, very much impacted by this pluralism and this emphasis on tolerance to an extreme. And so we have in our country virtually every religion in the world coexisting. What is religion anyway? You know, even the word religion is getting a bad name in our world. We have become so subjective in our thinking. Religion, as a matter of fact, is drowning in an ocean of the ambiguous and the sea of the nebulous. Let me read to you a section out of the Academic American Encyclopedia under the heading Religion. Religion is a complex phenomenon. Define definition or summary. Almost as many definitions and theories of religion exist as there are authors on the subject. So you see, everything is subjective. Religion is so ambiguous, it is so nebulous, that it's basically pretty much hopeless to nail down what it is. And with that kind of subjectivity and relative kind of thinking, is it any wonder that religion is obviously so divided as the secular world looks at it, and we have lost really our power and our influence because of that division? What secularist is going to look at religious folks, much less the faithful Christian, and give him credibility? When all of us are lumped together as religious folks in their view, and we are so radically divided, so subjective, and so relative in our thinking. The fact is, it's not so subjective, it's not so ambiguous, it's not nebulous. The word religion, the English word religion, comes from the Latin word religare, which literally means to tie back or to bind back. The idea of religion is the idea of God seeking man, and man seeking God. And really, it's what can be summarized in that one word, reconciliation. Religion has to do with reconciliation, with man and God being made friends again, being tied back together again, enjoying a communion again, separated, of course, by sin. And it is very much a part of who we are. In Acts chapter 17, I think there's certainly indication to that very fact, that religion is really bound up in who we are. Not just in what we do, but who we are too. In Acts chapter 17, when the Apostle Paul goes into the city of Athens, note the reading beginning at verse 22. As Paul declares to the people, "Ye men of Athens, in all things I perceive that you are very religious. For I passed along and observed the objects of your worship. I found also an altar with this inscription, to the unknown God. What therefore ye worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you. The God that made the world and all things therein, he, being Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is he served by men's hands, as though he needed anything, seeing he himself giveth to all life and breath and all things. He made of one every nation of men to dwell on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation, that they should seek God. If haply they might feel after him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and we move, and we have our own being. As certain even of your own prophets have said, for we also are the offspring of God." We are the offspring of God. And because of that, God in love reaches down to us. And God longs passionately for communion with his offspring. And we in turn seek him, because we are God's offspring. You see, religion is very much a very natural part of being the offspring of God, existing in his image. And so that is why the Apostle Paul said in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 20, "Be ye reconciled to God." Because that is the desire of God. And that is only natural for the Creator and the offspring to share communion. That, my friends, is what religion is all about. Does history really provide any indication of any peoples who didn't practice some form of religion? They practiced some form of religion, maybe in gross ignorance, but practiced that form of religion because of the way God made them, as those who exist in his image. Religion is not some sort of compulsive neurosis, as Sigmund Freud has suggested. And it is not some opiate of the mind for the common folk, as Marxism suggests. But instead, it's that very natural longing of God for man and man for God. But friends, not all religions are created equal. Not all religions exist equal. There are false religions. And it's because of that fact there ought to be lectureships with this very theme. I am reminded of a cartoon that originally appeared in the American Atheist magazine that had a dad that was sitting in a chair. He was reading the evening newspaper. His son brought to him a book. The book was titled Myths. The boy brought the book to Dad and said, "Dad, what's mythology?" Dad's reply, "It's a religion that has been found out." Well, there are some religions. There are numerous religions that, my friend, someday they are going to be found out and exposed for what they are. Just something being a religion does not make it meet with divine approval. False religions are not new. We should not really be that surprised. In Leviticus chapter 18 and verse 21, the children of Israel are forbade from participating in the practice of having their children pass through the fire to the god Molech. In Leviticus chapter 20, there is even more detail about this particular false religion that God was gravely concerned about his children participating in. Leviticus 20 begins this way. "And Jehovah spake unto Moses, saying, Moreover, thou shalt say to the children of Israel, Whosoever he be of the children of Israel, or of the strangers that sojourn in Israel, that giveth his seed unto Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones. I also will set my face against that man, and will cut him off from among his people, because he hath given of his seed unto Molech to defile my sanctuary and to profane my holy name. And if the people of the land do it, all hide their eyes from that Molech and put him not to death. Then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and will cut him off and all that play the harlot after him, to play the harlot with Molech from among their people." A false religion that existed side by side with Judaism at a time when Judaism was acceptable and the appropriate way to approach God. But it was a false religion. Participating in that false religion had its severe consequences. But yet Solomon set up his high places for sacrifices in this false religion in 1 Kings chapter 11. A false religion centered on a false god. Then we read about King Ahab and Jezebel promoting the false religion that centered on Balaam. And we find that there is a struggle that exists between the influence of Baal and Balaam and Judaism and the God of the Jews. And in 1 Kings chapter 18, we read about the challenge at Mount Carmel and how that Elijah took on well over 800 false prophets of their gods. And the God of heaven cooperates with Elijah to expose the false religion of those who chose to worship Baal. False religions. It's not a new thing. But we not only have the problem of false religions in our world. Man has not always only struggled with that, but has struggled also at times with taking the true and the right religion and ruining even that religion that initially and originally was approved of God. In Isaiah chapter 1, we read about Isaiah's writings to the people of his day, about how they had taken the right religion and they had just ruined it because they had become a people laden with iniquity. As a matter of fact, verse 4 of Isaiah chapter 1 explains, "Ah, sinful nation, a people laden with iniquity, a seed of evildoers, children that deal corruptly." These were people in a divinely approved religion, in covenant relationship with God, who had taken that religion and had just ruined it a little later, Isaiah writes in verse 10, "Hear the word of Jehovah. Ye rulers of Sodom, give ear unto the law of our God, ye people of Gomorrah. What unto me is the multitude of your sacrifices, saith Jehovah? I have had enough of your burnt offerings of rams and the fat of fed beasts, and delight not in the blood of bullocks or of lambs or of he-goats. When ye come to appear before me, who hath required this at your hand to trample my courts? Bring no more vain oblations." And then he explains, "The incense is an abomination unto me. New moon and Sabbath, the calling of assemblies, I cannot away with the iniquity and the solemn meeting. Your new moon and your appointed feast my soul hateth. They are a trouble unto me. I am weary of bearing them. And when you spread forth your hands, I will hide mine eyes from you. Yea, when you make many prayers, I will not hear." And then he explains why. "Your hands are full of blood." So he tells them the solution in verses 16 and 17. "Wash you, make clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. Learn to do well. Seek justice. Relieve the oppressed. Judge the fatherless. Plead for the widow." Here were people in the right religion, but who were not practicing that religion right. And because of that, they had drifted far afield from God to the point that He wouldn't hear their prayers any longer. He wouldn't accept their so-called solemn assemblies. Amos writes about the people and how that they would do their sacrificing, but yet would turn right around the next day and would neglect the widow, would rip off the poor. They had taken the heart out of religion, and they had drifted far afield from what God intended for them in that right religion. You see, we have the problem of false religions. Multitudes of false religions who really bear no semblance to the true religion. And then at the same time, we have the problem of those who may bear some semblance to the right religion, but yet really have ruined that by their thinking and by their practices, to the point where all that they are practicing is a counterfeit of that right religion. It's in that world, it's in this world, that we need to remember there is only one true religion. And that one true religion is the one that we need to learn about. And we need to practice in its pure state, and nothing less. In the book of Acts, repeatedly, Luke refers by inspiration to Christianity with a two-word distinguishing phrase that sets it apart from all the religions of the first century and all the religions that have ever surfaced before or since. And that two-word phrase is the way. In Acts chapter 9, when we're introduced to Saul, that passionate persecutor of Christians, in Acts chapter 9, in verse 1, we read, "Saul, yet breathing threatening and slaughter against the disciples of the Lord, went unto the high priest and asked him letters to Damascus unto the synagogues, that if he found any that were of the way, whether men or women, he might bring them bound to Jerusalem." And we, of course, know that as the beginning of the first account of his conversion to Christ. The high priest was present of the Sanhedrin. As the head of the Jewish state, his authority would have been probably accepted by the Roman government as a whole. Damascus had a large community of Jewish people and several synagogues. He's going to Damascus to get the authorization to continue his onslaught against Christianity. A Christianity described with that two-word phrase that sets it apart from all others: the way. In Acts chapter 19, we read about Paul's work in Ephesus. In Ephesus, the work was obviously a challenge because there were other religions there. We read in Acts chapter 19 and verse 8 about there being a synagogue there. The Jewish religion was there. In verse 19 of chapter 19, we read about the occult being practiced there and about the books that contained the various incantations and things that had to do with their magical arts in their practice of the occult. Here is a city that is described by Ian Blakelock in the Tyndale Commentary series as a hotbed of Oriental magic and superstition mixed with the influence of Judaism after the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. The Apostle Paul brings Christianity into the city. And isn't it interesting then that in the description of that Christianity, in that city where there were these divergent religious views, that it is Christianity and only Christianity that is described again with that two-word phrase. In chapter 19, verse 8 beginning, "And he entered into the synagogue and spake boldly for the space of 3 months, reasoning and persuading as to the things concerning the kingdom of God. But when some were hardened and disobedient, speaking evil of the way before the multitude, he departed from them and he separated the disciples, reasoning daily in the school of Tyrannus." They were speaking evil of what? The way. Of Christianity. Down in verse 23 of that same chapter, we read, "And about that time, there arose no small stir concerning the way." Obviously, Christianity is the way. But then, as if we have not driven home the point well enough, there's chapter 24 to look at as well. In chapter 24 and verse 14, we read about Paul making his defense before especially Felix. And in chapter 24 of the book of Acts, verse 14, the Bible says, in quoting Paul, "But this I confess unto thee, after the way which they call a sect, so serve I the God of our fathers." And then, when Felix has the opportunity to be challenged by the Apostle Paul, and he indeed, no doubt, has been impacted by Paul's presentation, note verse 22 of the chapter, as the Bible says, "But Felix, having more exact concerning now in regard to the way, deferred to them, saying, When Lysias the chief captain shall come down, I will determine your matter." Felix was learning more and more about the way. Christianity. The one true religion. The way. That two-word phrase separates Christianity from all other religions. And Brother Burton Kaufman, in his commentary on Acts, I think, makes an excellent point when he says, and I quote, "Implicit in such a name is the trueness and rightness of it." Unquote. What an appropriate distinguishing phrase for Christianity. To herald its appropriateness, its trueness, its rightness, its divine authority. Christianity is the way. Jesus did not come from heaven to leave on earth merely another religion to add to the ones that were already there or would multiply from those that were already there. When Jesus left heaven and came to earth, he came to bring the one and only true religion. And it bears his name as we follow him. Christianity. How appropriate that it be the one true religion. Jesus said, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." Thank you.